Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday. So, of course, anything goes Friday. Our second and third hours, we'll be taking your calls on pretty much any topic of the day. I have a feeling I know which direction it's going to mostly go. And our first hour, as always, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, our national town hall meeting. I think of him as America's senator. He is, of course, one of Vermont's two great senators, Pat Leahy, the other, and the independent from Vermont, neither a Democrat nor a Republican. His website, sanders.senate.gov. And we'll be taking calls for Bernie right after the first break at 866-303-2270. Your telephone calls, your opportunity to speak with a U.S. senator. Bernie, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here, Bernie. And I should let our listeners know we've got a new little bit of technology between you and me, so you sound a whole lot better. But we're not in the same room together, even though it may sound that way.
Good.
So what's up with the economy?
Well, I think every listener knows what's up with the economy, and that is that we're looking at the most serious economic crisis since the Great Depression. It is really, really frightening. I know it's scary in my state. It's scary all over this country. Unemployment now is higher than it has been in the last 14 years. In the last 3 months alone, Tom, over a million Americans have lost their jobs. And just last November, over 500,000 Americans have lost their jobs. And when people lose their jobs, they're in danger of losing their homes, not being able to pay their mortgages. They're losing their health insurance. They're losing their ability to send their kids to college. They're losing their pensions and their ability to have a dignified retirement. So we are looking at a major, major economic crisis precipitated to a significant degree by the greed on Wall Street, where people have become involved in esoteric, enormously complicated financial instruments, which have led to the collapse or the virtual collapse of the international financial system. And then you got all the ripple effects from that. So I think the first thing, and we can never, never forget this, we can never forget what the greed on Wall Street has done, not only to our country, but to the entire world. We have to do a much better job understanding how we got to where we are right now. And we have to immediately, as quickly as possible, make sure that this never happens again, that we bring, at the very least, transparency, regulation to the derivatives market, to the hedge funds who are playing with trillions and trillions of dollars, and we have very little understanding about what they are doing. Just the front page story in the Wall Street Journal today about some guy who is now under arrest for doing a Ponzi scheme for some $50 billion, and on it goes. So before we're ever going to be able to get our economic house in order, I think we have to understand what is going on in Wall Street, deal with this too-big-to-fail business. I worry very much, and I've said this before, that, A, if an institution is too big to fail, it's too big to exist. And if you have financial instruments that are too complicated for anybody to understand, then they shouldn't exist either. So we need some very radical changes in terms of the way Wall Street does business. Second of all, we are right now, and President-elect Obama, I think, is moving us in the right direction, talking about a very, very significant stimulus package. I voted against the bailout of Wall Street because I had zero confidence in the Bush administration in terms of oversight, in terms of doing the right thing, and less confidence in these banks that were receiving the money. On the other hand, what we do need to do is create millions of good-paying jobs, dealing with the very long-ignored needs of our infrastructure. We have bridges that are collapsing, roads that need repair, water systems that need work, school construction. We have hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of unmet needs in infrastructure, and we can put millions of people to work starting to rebuild our country. And the second part of the infrastructure package is the absolute need to end our dependency on foreign oil, and the need to break our dependency on fossil fuel in general, move to energy efficiency, move to sustainable energy. And that is just so, so important, not only because we are now importing about $500 billion a year of foreign oil, but because long-term, if we're going to deal with global warming, if we're becoming, we're going to become energy independent, we need to grow significantly the solar industry and solar technology. I have legislation in that would provide for 10 million solar rooftops in this country. And the more we produce, the more jobs we create, the cheaper the technology becomes. Wind is sitting out there, not only big wind farms, but in rural America, smaller wind turbines. Geothermal has huge potential. Biomass has potential. A lot of other technologies out there. We can do that. We really can do it. But it's going to take a major commitment. We're going to need the kind of leadership that a new president is going to bring us, strong efforts on the part of Congress. But we can create millions of jobs in that area as well. And in the midst of all of this, obviously we understand that with 47 million Americans without any health insurance, more uninsured, we have to significantly improve our capacity to deliver health care in this country. We are working very hard to see that community health centers are established in every underserved area in America so that we can get primary health care, dental care, low-cost prescription drugs to people all over this country. We have to make, in my state of Vermont, and I know in many states, emergency shelters are now overflowing. Families don't have a place to sleep. And we have to deal with affordable housing. We have to make sure the people in this country in the midst of this crisis do not go hungry. So we have just an enormous amount of work in front of us. We are ending the administration, the tenure of, you know, perhaps the worst president in the history of our country. And we're just going to have to suffer another month through that. And then we have to begin to go to work big time.
Yeah. Bernie, two quick questions. The first, the lead headline in today's Financial Times, buyout funds dry up on fears of, quote, Armageddon, end quote. They're talking about a financial Armageddon, about the possibility the United States could go down the road of Argentina. Are people in the United States Senate as concerned about this as some people on the international equivalent of Wall Street seem to be?
Well, you know, Tom, we are in an unprecedented era where not a whole lot of people really understand what went on. I mean, if you take a deep breath and you take a look at where we are right now, and you say, gee, the Bush administration, not so many months ago, was telling us that the foundations, you remember this? The foundations,
yeah,
foundations of the economy are strong. So forget the politics here. How in God's name was a crisis of this magnitude able to occur with nobody knowing that it was about to take place?
Well, my personal conspiracy theory is that they knew it was going to happen, but they figured it would happen after January 1st, and they blame it on the Democrats.
Well, I don't know about that, but I think what we do know is that we're in unprecedented territory. We're dealing with derivatives, and we're dealing with trillions of dollars floating around in an unregulated territory without any transparency. We don't know. That's the problem. Yeah. So some people say there's an Armageddon coming. I don't know that anybody really does know what's going on.
Yeah.
Last night at midnight or 11 o'clock or something, we voted on the auto bailout. I voted reluctantly for that, not because I have any confidence in the management of the big three, but because I worry at a time when we're hemorrhaging good-paying jobs, the possibility of seeing millions of more manufacturing jobs going down the tubes and the ripple effect that will have, that can only precipitate a major economic crisis and make it even worse.
And let me provide a context here, Bernie, that I'm not hearing anybody talk about. $15 billion divided by 3 million jobs is $5,000 per job. Shelby is all self-righteous, but his state gave over $250,000 per job to Mercedes to move to Alabama. You know, on average, these guys paid over $150,000 a job to five different foreign auto manufacturers to move to four different states. And they want to blow up a loan, not a bailout, a loan that only costs $5,000 per job to save these jobs. I mean, this seems to me nuts.
Well, you got a lot of things going on that we should be clear of. I mean, the other point to be made is, Tom, is that if one or two of the big three go down, who do you think is going to pick up the pensions that are owed to these workers? It's going to be the federal government.
Yep.
Who's going to be picking up the unemployment compensation? Who's going to be picking up the increased cost for Medicaid? So what you're talking about is significant increase to the federal government for unemployment, pensions, health care, and other areas as millions of people lose their work. I agree with you. I think it makes a lot more sense to simply provide a bridge loan, demand fundamental restructuring of the industry, but do everything we can to save those jobs, especially at this very delicate moment in terms of our economy.
Yeah, but the hypocrisies of these Republicans on the one hand. On the other hand, they're starting to get honest about the fact that really it's all about busting labor.
That's right. That's the other point that I was
saying. I mean, they want to break up the UAW.
That is exactly right.
They don't want the UAW coming to their states. And really, organized labor is the last true progressive organized force in the country.
No, that is exactly right, and that is at the heart and soul, in my view, of the Republican opposition.
Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls right after the break, 866-303-2270. His website, sanders.senate.gov. You can subscribe to his newsletter there as well. TomHartmann.com for your live chat room. AirAmerica.com for our free video stream.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, the True People's Radio. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Bernie, ready to take some phone calls?
Let's do it.
All righty. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Wallace in Houston, Texas. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Wow, Tom and Senator Sanders, it's an honor to speak with you. It really is. Hey, I know this is going to make me sound like a racist and an anti-immigrant, which I'm not. But seeing as the central element of President-elect Obama's economic stimulus plan is infrastructure jobs, such as building roads and bridges, if all the contractors the government hires use illegal Mexican or other Latin American nationals to do the work, which they invariably do here in Houston area, which is where I live, which then results in, you know, very low-paying jobs and a large part of those wages being sent back to Mexico or other countries to support their families there, how is that going to help the American economy? I mean, won't all we really be doing is boosting Latin American economies?
Well, that's a good point, Wallace, and I don't think that's a racist comment. Among many other areas in labor issues, we have been working very hard on this both H-1B program and H-2B program. And bottom line is, if somebody is in this country illegally, they should not be in this country. It doesn't mean to say that you throw 12 million people out, you don't do that, and you figure out a way, in my view, over a period of time that people can get citizenship. But you cannot allow employers to be hiring illegal labor when we have so many citizens in this country who desperately need jobs. So I would suspect and strongly support a stimulus package which makes sure that the people who are hired to do the work are citizens of the United States.
Yeah,
or are here legally.
Yeah, exactly. James in New Paul's, New York. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, Tom, it's always a pleasure. Gentlemen, I apologize for my visceral tone, but the events of the past 24 hours or more regarding this aid to the auto companies, I refuse to use the word bailout. It just doesn't sound right. Just offends me, and I think of the actions of these senators, and I understand treason is a very strong word, and it's probably not legally appropriate, but are these men acting as United States senators or as agents of a foreign corporation? And why aren't they being called on it?
Well, I wouldn't use the word treason. I don't, you know. But what I think you have is people from different regions are approaching this problem in very different ways. I think Tom put his finger on it a moment ago, that I think at the heart of the opposition for at least a number of senators is certainly a strong dislike of trade unions, understanding that when workers get together collectively and organize, not only can they negotiate for better wages, which many of these guys don't like that idea, but they're also active politically. So if in this process they could break the UAW, that would be a real, that would be frosting on the cake. That would be a really good thing. Your point, James, is that some of these senators represent states where you have foreign automobile companies, and it might be advantageous if one or two of the big three went down. Believe me, that is a point that many of us are not unaware of.
Bert in Madison, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, hi. Without spending so-called political capital, I'm hoping that Obama and the Congress would appoint a commission of jurists and other prominent Americans. And this commission should quickly look into the possibility, not the probability, possibility of criminal activities such as torture, war crimes, illegal eavesdropping. And whenever they find such a possibility, they should appoint a special prosecutor such as Patrick Fitzgerald, perhaps a dozen, perhaps two dozen such prosecutors to investigate and prosecute. In the meantime, Congress can work on health care, the economy, and other tasks uninterrupted by, because the prosecutors will be taking on that task. And I think this is absolutely critical for the soul of this country. I think it's the number one task that we have before us, even before the economy, because I feel it's like a family that finds out that their children have been stealing things. The goodies they have in the room, the electronics have all been stolen, and they're going to talk to the kids about that. And then they say, well, wait a second, they've got the the college entrance exams coming up, and we don't want to disturb them. So, we'll wait till later. We'll discuss it at some other time.
Bert, I don't think it's a question of waiting till later. I think this country faces so many problems that we have to be aggressive in many, many areas. I think clearly, if President Obama and the Congress did not move aggressively on the economy, you're going to have tens and tens of millions of people really, really suffering. So we've got to deal with that. We have to move toward repairing our disintegrating healthcare system and join the rest of the industrialized world so that all of our people have health care as a right of citizenship. And the issue that you are raising is for the new Congress, the new president, special prosecutors, to take a hard look at the ways that the Bush administration may have acted illegally. And I share that concern. Certainly one of the areas where this administration has been just a disaster is not understanding the Constitution and under the guise of fighting terrorism, believing that they had the right to do anything they wanted, whether it was legal or not legal. And obviously we have to take a hard look and understand all of what they did. We know some of what they did. We have to undo the damage, and we have to see where those investigations lead us.
It almost feels like we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, if not a prosecution, because we just need to air some of this stuff. Bernie Sanders with us, Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, taking your calls. His website, sanders.senate.gov. We're at tomhartman.com if you want to drop into our free live chat room, our free live video stream over at airamerica.com. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
866-303-2270. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight.
Now, thank goodness for holidays occasionally. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the air with us, with you, taking your calls. And Ramon in Hyattsville, Maryland, you're on with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Mrs. Sanders, I actually want to talk about the auto companies for about a moment here.
Okay.
I did want to point out that the auto companies basically have repeated their mistakes. Back in the 1970s, the automobile companies were emphasizing horsepower on the old muscle cars. And then you have the OPEC coming to being, and basically the exact same thing has happened before. Is there any guarantee you all can get them to come up with the fuel economy standards on their cars from here on out? I think that's the biggest thing. I was also going to point out that GM Pontiac also had the old Fiero, and a lot of the newer owners in the Fieros, they're ripping out the old engines, they're swapping in the newer engines like the Quad 4 and GM and the Northstar, and basically they're getting better fuel economy than the Fiero when it first came out.
Well, Ramon, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I think you make a very good point. I think there is a widespread understanding, and what I can tell you from personal experience is that whenever here in Congress we tried to do things like increase fuel efficiency and our CAFE standards, the people who opposed us most strongly was the automobile manufacturers in Detroit. I can remember just a couple of years ago walking into an auto show when everybody is talking about global warming, everybody is talking about cutting back on greenhouse gas emissions, and the largest display was, in fact, for the Hummer. So I think Ramon makes a good point that in many ways these guys have missed golden opportunities. I think the average American, everything being equal, wants to buy a good quality, energy-efficient car manufactured in the United States of America. But the big three, in many ways, have not given us that opportunity. Having said that, we should be aware right now that it is not just the big three that are not selling cars. Toyota is having substantial problems. There have been a significant downturn in their sales, as has Honda. This is tied in certainly to the credit crisis and the
Sweden is bailing out Saab today. Just announced a $3.2 billion bailout for Saab in Sweden. Pardon
so this is certainly not just a big three problem. But I think Ramon's point is a good point, not only in terms of Detroit not producing the kind of energy-efficient cars that the American people want. I can remember seeing that movie, Who Killed the Electric Car? Tom, did you see that?
It's amazing.
Amazing. Here you had a car that was popular. It worked very well in California. The day after the law expired and they didn't have to have it, they physically began destroying these cars. So there's no question that in many respects Detroit has been reactionary. There's no question that we need fundamental restructuring. But where we are right now is I think we've got to do everything we can to prevent any one of these big three from collapsing completely. Not only are we talking about the loss of millions of decent-paying jobs, we're talking, and Tom and I over the years have often discussed this issue, that a country cannot be a great nation. We can't have a strong economy unless we are producing real products. And if you see manufacturing in this country continue to decline, I think it just speaks to the decline of our entire economy. It really distresses me that a few years ago, 40% of the profits in the United States were made on Wall Street. So you're seeing the profits on Wall Street growing and growing, and manufacturing in the United States declining and declining, and we have got to reverse that big time. And that's why, at the moment, we've got to do what we can to provide a bridge loan for the automobile industry.
Just a footnote for the Who Killed the Electric Car. The nickel hydride battery technology that was invented in 1990 by a husband and wife couple that was sold to GM that made that car possible was then sold by GM when they killed the electric car to Texaco, which was then bought by Chevron for $100 billion. And Chevron has been sitting on the patent of that and not allowing those batteries to be manufactured that would provide for long-term, long-distance electric cars. So the technology is out there. It's just nobody's manufacturing it because they're sitting on the patent. So just
I mean, that's just totally absurd.
Yeah, but it's an oil company. They don't want electric cars. So right. Stacy in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. I'm so angry and I'm so upset. I mean, clearly this is class warfare. And on Oberman last night, he said that in order for the automakers in Detroit, Shelby wants them to be on a parity with the Toyota in his state, they'd have to get a raise. The Toyota workers in his state are getting paid more than the United Auto Workers. But really what I want to ask you, Bernie, is I appreciate the fact that you are a select fraternity in the U.S. Senate and you treat each other with respect. But did anybody call Shelby out when he stood there and said?
Stood there and said?
I'm sorry. I just want to know if anybody called him out when he was railing about how much money the auto workers are getting when his state paid more money, as you said, Tom. I mean, almost 200. They bought 2,500 Mercedes to use as fleet vehicles in the state of Alabama.
Right.
Well, Stacy, I think.
Thank you, Stacy.
Thank you for your point. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I didn't listen to the entire debate, but. What I think people have been calling out opponents of helping the auto manufacturers on is there was an entire distortion of reality going around, which was saying, I think, that the average automobile worker was making, $75 an hour or something like
that?
Yeah,
71, I think.
And it was just a complete distortion of reality because one of the major problems that the auto industry has, the big three have, is they have something like 1 million retirees for whom they are supplying health care and pensions, as opposed to Honda and Toyota, who have virtually no retirees because they're newer in this country. And there was just a gross distortion about what the members of the UAW were making. This, and the second point that I want to make, if you take a deep breath and you understand that the middle class in this country is collapsing, and if you look at what, in fact, is going on in Detroit today, that the UAW has already made major concessions so that as older workers retire, they're being replaced by newer workers who are making, in some cases, as I understand it, about half the wages, $14 an hour.
Yep.
Now, if you're going to make historically, the automobile industry has been the gold standard for wages for manufacturing workers in this country. And if you keep beating that down, that not only impacts automobile workers, it impacts every worker in America. How is a blue-collar worker in the state of Vermont who does not have a strong union behind him, how is that man or woman going to make a living if automobile workers are making $14 an hour? That's the best that we can do in America. What that really is saying is goodbye middle class, goodbye decent standard of living for blue collar workers. That's what a significant part of this debate was about. And you know, the other point is, you don't hear, these guys are so worried that the workers in the automobile industry are making so much money. I didn't hear them over the years talking about the hundreds of millions of dollars being made by these Wall Street financiers. I didn't hear a word about that. I didn't hear one word of concern about the fact that the top one-tenth of 1% earns more income than the bottom 50%. Didn't hear any word about that. These guys stay up nights, some of these Republicans, worrying that a working person, a blue-collar worker, could actually make a middle-class standard of living. What a terrible thing from their perspective.
Yeah, and we just heard Bank of America is laying off 35,000 workers. What they didn't say is that Bank of America is shedding 35,000 American jobs. I just got an email yesterday from a Bank of America customer who was going on and on about how he called Bank of America about customer service and ended up talking to somebody in the Philippines who he could barely understand, couldn't solve his problem. He called back several times, ended up keep getting different people who didn't know what they were talking about, were outside the United States. You know, is Bank of America going to dump 35,000 American jobs and hire another 50,000 in the Philippines or something? I mean, it's crazy.
Well, Tom, I mean, it's not crazy. It's quite consistent with what right-wing ideology is. And I think what this financial crisis should make every American aware is that all of these right-wing ideas, which is unfettered free trade, the idea that it's perfectly fine, that it's good, that you shut down plants in America, you move to China, you hire people there at 50 cents an hour, you bring the product back in this country, that's wonderful. That deregulation, that we should not have government oversight over the financial services industry, that we should trust these guys to do the right thing, well, we got to get rid of that idea as well. Tax breaks for billionaires, and somehow that money is going to trickle down and create a strong economy for all of us. All of these things, this is the wish list of the large multinational corporations and the wealthiest people in this country. They have gotten their way for the last several decades. It is time to fundamentally rethink that whole ideology. Unfettered free trade, trickle-down economics, anti-unionism, deregulation, all of that stuff. And we got to put a new economic structure in place to start protecting the middle class and working families of this country rather than the top 1%.
Yeah, well said. We have about a half a minute before the break here. David in Miami, Florida, quick point.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Senator, I was wondering if both houses were willing to resign, and you included, because you guys are the problem. The American people are sick of you senators and all your crap and all your weird.
Yeah, okay, David, enough.
No, let David. No.
I'm sorry, I dumped this call.
No. I want David to have his point.
I was concerned he was going to start getting obscene.
Well, we don't want obscenity.
But let's deal with David's call. When we come back from the break, you'll respond to that, okay?
Yes, I will.
Great. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, Brunch with Bernie, and I will restrain my trigger finger here in the future. Thank you, Bernie. 866-303-2270, our number. The lines are all filled right now, so we'll be getting back to your calls right after this. Sanders.Senate.gov. Check it out.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
to steal it again.
Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, no, don't think so. The Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. Brunch with Bernie, our hour with Bernie Sanders. And Bernie, you had a, we had a caller just before the break. I just want to explain real quickly. I had a guest yesterday who dropped an obscenity on the air. And my apologies to all of our affiliates for that. And it has, and so I was operating on a little post-traumatic stress disorder here.
Hi, the reason I wanted to hear David out is there are millions of people today, Tom, who are furious, they're confused, they're lashing out at every institution that they can. And David seemed to think that in Washington, all of us hold the same views. All of you guys should resign. Doesn't matter whether your views are the president or right-wing Republicans or the most progressive member of the Senate. You're all together. You're all the same. Resign. Well, that's just not a well-thought-out proposition. I think what we need to think about is how we got to where we got, to understand that ideology is extremely important and that we need fundamental changes in the way government does business today so that instead of, as we have done for the last 8 years, represent the interests of the wealthy and powerful, we start developing concepts and approaches which represent the needs of working families, the middle class, and lower income people. And David doesn't understand that. He's hurting. Maybe he lost his job, and I can understand that. Maybe he doesn't have any health care. Maybe his kids are sick and can't find a doctor. He's angry, and he should be angry. But what David has got to understand is what the causes of the problems are and how we go from where we are today to a whole different direction. And among other things, some of the issues that some of us are fighting for is to not only deal with the grossly unfair distribution of wealth and income in this country, but also the issue of power. Who has the power? Here in Washington, members of Congress are dependent on big money interests to get elected. So you have all of these special interests, whether it's the insurance companies, the drug companies, the military-industrial complex. All these companies provide huge amounts of campaign funds. They get access as a result of that. What's the antidote to that? To my mind, it is public funding of elections. So we can break the stranglehold that these big money interests have over Congress. David may not understand that, but that is a reality. We need campaign finance reform. We need to rethink the ideology of Bush and Phil Graham and all of these guys. We need to re-regulate the financial industry. We need to move this country in the same direction that every other major country in the world is, through a national health care program guaranteeing health care to all people. We have to do away with all of the anti-union legislation that exists right now and a National Labor Relations Board, which is very clearly pro-big business. So when workers want to come together and form a union, they are able to do that. We need to understand that in a civilized democratic society, we should not have people sleeping out on the street. We should not have Americans going hungry. We need to strengthen our safety net. We need, as I mentioned a moment ago, to deal with this issue, unfettered free trade. We have major corporations, and you raised that issue, not only blue-collar jobs going over to China, but white-collar jobs going over to India. Is trade a good thing? It is. But trade policy has got to reflect working people's needs and not simply the CEOs of large corporations. So the reason I wanted to hear David out is I think he speaks to millions of people. People are angry, and they're lashing out. But the bottom line is anger is not going to solve our problems. We got to think this thing through. We got to understand why we are where we are today, why the rich get richer while the middle class is shrinking. What are those policies that have led us to where we are today? And we got to change those policies.
Yeah. Well said. Thank you, Bernie. Terry in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. You're on with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator. I was wondering, I was watching the debate last night, and Senator Baucus brought up an issue with the silo, S-I-L-O, that was apparently stuck in by the House of Representatives, and he and fellow Montana Senator Tester couldn't vote for the package. Could you explain that a little bit?
What it is in what was primarily a bailout for the automobile industry, they also in the House included a provision that would help some of the transit authorities in this country who have also got mired into a problem relating to a kind of esoteric tax policy, which have left them in a deep hole, and that's what that was about.
Mm. Is that going to be solved with separate legislation or something like that? Or?
Well, I'm not sure that it's something I'm not particularly sympathetic to. But that is a whole other issue.
Okay. Sean in Vancouver, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, you've been in the trenches of Congress shouting from the rooftops 15, 20 years ago when these same band of criminals were pulling off like the SNL bailout and NAFTA and the Mexican peso rescue.
Yep.
Now, with any band of criminals, they do these trial runs, and it seems like it was a big setup for the biggest bank caper of all time. I mean, these derivative products, they're not opaque, and they're complex, and they're opaque intentionally because they've been setting up this trial run all this time, and you were there shouting from the rooftops trying to get everyone's attention. And I just commend you for what you're doing, you know. And just one last thing. Che Guevara reportedly once was asked why he was a Marxist, and he said, well, it's not my fault that reality in South America is Marxist. I was wondering if you'd be willing to elaborate a little bit on that, too.
Well,
thank you.
I don't know about
We should qualify that you're not a Marxist.
Although what we can say is that in recent years, Latin America has undergone a major political transformation, and institutions like the International Monetary Fund no longer have very much authority, and many governments in Latin America have taken a very different approach away from neoconservatism. I think Sean makes a very important point in the sense that anyone who thinks that the current financial crisis is altogether new is missing the boat. As Sean pointed out, we went through the peso crisis, the greed of Wall Street investing in Mexico, we went through the Asian crisis, we went through the savings and loan bailout. This is a bigger caper, but it is consistent with practices in the past.
Yeah, back where we started with Ronald Reagan. Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Check out his website. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It's always wonderful having you out. Back with Anything Goes Friday. Your calls on any topic, 866-303-2270. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the Dow has moved into positive territory. I'm guessing that the reason why is because the Treasury Department, old Ben Bernanke, excuse me, not Ben Bernanke, Hank Paulson, Hanky Panky Paulson, as Christine Alexander on our morning show refers to him. Mr. Paulson is talking about using some of that $15 billion he's got left before he has to go back to Congress to get more to bail out the auto companies. Meanwhile, you've got members of the Senate running around making wild and, frankly, in my opinion, irresponsible statements about how it's all the fault of the unions, right? It's all about the unions, and we got to get rid of the unions. The unions, they're making too much money. Well, there's two problems with this. One, they're not making too much money. It's a lie. In fact, new hires at the big three, in some cases, are making as little as $14 or $15 an hour. And the average wage is $27 an hour, which is about what it is at the Mercedes and Honda plants down in Alabama. Number two, you've got the companies down in Alabama and South Carolina and Kentucky. By coincidence, the states where these Republicans are trying to bring Detroit to its knees are from those auto plants. Do not want the UAW in their door. They would like to see a stake driven through the heart of the UAW, and that's what these senators are trying to do, these Republican senators. This is not about General Motors. It's not about Ford. It's got nothing to do with them. This is about trying to destroy organized labor. I can give you a long list of the mistakes that Ford and GM have made, and frankly, many of the other companies. You know, some of the Japanese auto manufacturers have been among the most aggressive recently in coming to market with the trucks and larger vehicles. None of that is the point. The point here, what's going on here, and I've been saying this from day one, and it just astounds me that so many other commentators, particularly people on our side, never got it. They always thought it was about, you know, well, it's the stupid management or something. You know, no. What this is about is the last attempt to destroy organized labor. One of the strongest pieces of organized labor is the United Auto Workers and broadly speaking, all the jobs that are associated with the auto industry. And this is plain old, flat out, nothing more, nothing less than an attempt to destroy the American labor movement. Forget about GM and Ford, the labor movement. The last thing is because what's going to be coming down the road, and I'm telling you, it's going to get hysterical when this starts happening. I had on the morning show, and I did a Carl Wilson was gone today. He's in Nebraska doing a gig, and so I filled in for him on the morning show on AM 620 KPOJ along with Christine Alexander, who is wonderful. And we just walked into the studio. Thank you, Christine. And Tom Chamberlain was in here with us. Tom is the president of the AFL-CIO here in Oregon. And he said, he made the comment that, you know, the first 180 days of the Barack Obama administration, expect to see the Employee Free Choice Act come rolling down the road. And we will. And he said, you think you've seen hysteria up to this point. You ain't seen nothing yet. It is going to get absolutely crazy, over the top, you know, boffo. Here, during the election, for example, here in Oregon, and I know this is happening all over the country, they were customized to the individual races. They were running ads against Jeff Merkley, who is now our new senator, our new Democratic senator, and good on him for it. He's a good guy. They were running ads. The Gordon Smith campaign, the Republican senator from Oregon, was running ads that were the Employee Free Choice. You want to have the right to a secret vote, don't you? And, you know, this whole thing, this is going to come back times 500. You're going to see a war over the Employee Free Choice Act like you've never seen before, because these guys are terrified. And they're trying to do the preemptive strike, take down as much labor as possible so there's nobody there, so that these guys don't have jobs anymore and their union's out of business, so that they will not be able to be going door to door, knocking on doors, saying and making phone calls and running phone banks and doing the things that organized labor does so well, of putting pressure on their members of Congress to say, better vote for the Employee Free Choice Act. Or to say to these right-wingers in Kentucky and Alabama and South Carolina, better not filibuster that thing, or we're going to have your butt on a plate, or your head on a plate, would be the more correct metaphor, I guess. Metaphorically speaking. In other words, look out, if you're up for re-election in 2010, look out, Charlie, because we're not going to forget this. This is all about destroying organized labor, because organized labor, and again, it's got nothing from the Republicans' point of view. They like the fact that people are making less money, the working people are making less money, because it means that you have a less organized, less active middle class. And a strong and active middle class will always push back against Republican policies. Ever since the 1880s, this has 100% been the case. So, you know, it's a bonus for them that they get to destroy the middle class. This is one area where I slightly disagree with Bernie. Bernie's saying, you know, they want to destroy the middle class, and it's a bonus for them that they destroy the unions. I think it's the other way around. I think that they've been trying to destroy the union. I know that they've been trying to destroy the unions since 1935, when the Wagner Act was passed in the Roosevelt administration that made unionization and union shops possible. And from 1935 until 1947, in 1947, in the election of 46, the Republicans took control of the House and Senate. And in 47, not only did they refuse to consider Harry Truman's proposal for a national health care, national single-payer health care program. Yes, that was proposed by the President of the United States, a Democrat, in 1947. Not only did they refuse to handle that, but they passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which allowed states to opt out of essentially large chunks of the Wagner Act, which provided for unionization. So you had these so-called right-to-work states where a state could simply declare, we're not going to participate in this federal law anymore. We're not going to protect labor in our state. And most of the southern states did it. These southern senators, they've got slavery in their blood. And part of it was that they basically want to continue being slave masters. They want to say, you know, workers have no rights whatsoever. They have to do what the master says. And part of it, and a larger part of it, was that they're terrified of the idea of workers organizing into small d democracies, which is what unions are. They're democracies. And God forbid we should have democracies, democratic institutions operating in the United States. It's not the Republican way. Chris Matthews always makes this joke on MSNBC, and he's so right about it. About once a month, he pulls this thing out, and I love it when he says, you know, Republicans are always looking for a leader, and Democrats are always looking for a meeting to go to. And he's right. And the reason why is because Republicans don't believe in democracy, and Democrats do. And so Democrats want to get as many people together as possible, hear every point of view, and then vote. And Republicans want some shining star. They want the Mitt Romney or the Sarah Palin. They want the savior to come in and say, we're going to tell you how to do it. Don't worry, I'm in charge here. And it's the fundamental difference. And the democratic institution in this country, which is the most powerful, which turned out the most votes in the last election. I mean, they're trying to roll back the election of Barack Obama. Had there not been organized labor in the United States in the 2008 election, there's a very real probability, in my opinion, that the president right now would be John McCain. And that several Senate seats and quite a few House seats would not have moved Democratic, because there wouldn't have been an infrastructure in place for decades with leadership and telephones and an address and a meeting hall that people can go to that could organize people to go door to door and get out there and get out the vote. And yes, the Obama campaign did a brilliant job of pulling people together to do that, but it's not going to last forever. It's not an institution that you're paying dues to every month. It's not an organization that you feel loyalty to. It's not, voting for Obama doesn't make you an Obamaite or something like that. I mean, there's a few people who are very, very, but I'm telling you, when he starts actually legislating, when the tough decisions have to be made, he's going to step on some toes. He's going to step on some of my toes. He's going to step on some of your toes. He's going to step on a lot of right-wing toes. It's going to be hard to keep together that coalition. And frankly, I think that he's going to have to do it by the same tool, using the same method that Franklin Roosevelt did, which is calling these guys out and labeling them. Franklin Roosevelt talked about the economic royalists. These economic royalists, they think that you shouldn't have the right to work. I mean, Roosevelt just came right out and said, these economic royalists complain that we seek to destroy the institutions of America. What they really complain about, Roosevelt said, is that we seek to take away their power. And our allegiance to democratic institutions, our allegiance to America requires, Roosevelt said, requires the overthrow of this kind of power. Now, that's how Roosevelt did it in 1936. You get a audio of his or read the transcript. In fact, we printed the whole thing in, as I recall, my book Screwed. It might be in Cracking the Code. It's in one or the other of FDR's 1936 acceptance speech, because it's so brilliant, where he's just repeatedly calling these guys out and labeling them as economic royalists. If Barack Obama doesn't do that, he's not going to hold his coalition together. But I'm telling you what this is all about, this whole auto bailout battle. It's got nothing to do with the car companies. It's all about the unions.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Well, it looks like Al Franken got a tip of the hat today from the State Canvassing Board in Minnesota. A fine thing it is. There's roughly 1,500 absentee ballots, many of them, in fact, most of them, from heavily Democratic areas that the Coleman camp, Norm Coleman, by the way, under investigation by the FBI right now for corruption. Is he the next Rod Blagojevich? May well be. That the Coleman camp had contested ballots, like where somebody would fill in the little circle for Franken and then next to it they would write Franken. And the Coleman camp saying, well, that's a damaged ballot. That's an invalid ballot. That's not done correctly. And unanimously, the state canvassing board said, we ought to figure out what the intent of the voter is and count the votes so that the voters' votes get counted. It's not rocket science. And since so many of these Coleman challenges, were in heavily Democratic areas, obviously knowing that they would go for Franken, this may well mean that Al Franken is going to be the next senator from Minnesota. Let's hope. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Scott in Houston, Texas. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you as always, buddy.
Thanks for calling.
Tom, one thing that kind of struck me when the congressmen were, the senators were talking to the automakers and making a big deal about the labor union's wages. You know, I'm glad you brought it up, and I don't think I've heard any of the other commentators comment on it. I don't know the exact current salary of you know, House members and Senate, but I just ran it.
It's 180 grand, isn't it?
Well, I thought it was like 170 for House and like 185 for Senate. That could be
it's
off.
It's in that neighborhood.
Bit, it's very close. At 170, the average person, 40-hour work week, works 2,080 hours a year. For those congressmen, at 170 grand, that comes out to $81.73 an hour. That's without any benefits. Now, I can't understand how anyone would put any credence in what they're saying, because frankly, a lot of us, no offense to Mr. Sanders, I'm sure he works hard for his money, he's one of the few that does, but how can they say a guy making $30 or $40 an hour doesn't deserve that, when that includes their benefits and what have you, if they move it up to the higher numbers they're quoting, where the congressmen are making almost $82 an hour without any benefits included?
Right, and probably well over 90, maybe even over 100 when you consider their benefits, because their benefits are every bit as in fact, far more rich than the benefits of anybody working for the UAW.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, they, you know, a lot of stuff's come out. They have their staff picking up their dry cleaning, doing some of their re-election work.
Well, and if you added in all the retired members of the House and Senate who are drawing pensions and who are drawing health benefits, and you did the math the way that Fox News did the math for the UAW guys, I'll bet the average senator's making $200 or $300 an hour.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, they get, I forget what they call it, franking privileges, you know, the mailing and all that stuff. I mean, you're right. They're probably making over $100 an hour. So, I applaud you for bringing that up. I wish a few more commentators would, because a lot of people, even friends of mine, have said, oh, you know, they're making $70 an hour. It's like, of course they're not. If that's coming out of Fox News, it might as well be coming out of Pravda.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, thank you very much for the call. Well said, and thanks for a great talking point. I will borrow it. I'm assuming you don't mind. Deborah in Coconut Grove, Florida. Hey, Deborah, what's up?
Yes, hey, sorry, I had you on speakerphone because I wasn't sure how long it would take. Are you there?
I am.
Okay. First of all, I love your voice of reason. I tune in whenever I can.
Deborah, are we still on speakerphone?
No, can you hear me?
Oh, okay. Yes, I hear you just fine.
No, I just have one really simple question, and that is, why isn't big oil bailing out the car companies?
That's a good one. You know, there is a symbiotic relationship there. I would say that probably the reason why is because big oil doesn't care. People, we have this infrastructure that has caused us to become addicted to cars. And what's happening isn't that people are not driving, although we have cut back on our driving somewhat. It's still, you know, a single-digit percentage. But it's that people are deciding to keep a car for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years rather than replace it 2 or 3 or 4 years. And, you know, people are doing, the next to the last car that I had, I put over 110,000 miles on it. I gave it to my son, and he put another 100,000 miles on it before it finally died. And, you know, that's what, you know, some folks do. I mean, they buy a car and drive it into the ground. And I think increasingly people are doing that, and that's not good for an industry that's continually, you know, offering new models. But it's not going to change oil consumption. So, in fact, for that matter, if the older cars are less fuel efficient, the last thing the oil companies would want to do is bail out General Motors and whatnot, because then they'd be making more fuel efficient cars, which is going to drive down demand for oil. So that would be my guess.
Yeah, well, it just, you know, as logical a question as it is, I guess big oil is just going to have to get with the times sooner or later. And, you know, here you have a huge corporate infrastructure. Yeah, they could think of going into alternative sources of energy. You know, I mean, they've got to get with the program here.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, BP, and thank you for the call on that, Deborah. British Petroleum has reinvented themselves as Beyond Petroleum, BP. And, you know, we're now green, and we're the largest manufacturer of solar panels in the world and all this kind of stuff. But the fact of the matter is they're in the oil business. And ExxonMobil doesn't even bother to basically try to greenwash themselves. And by the way, it's not just the oil industry. Have you seen these new ads for clean coal where the guy goes out and says, see this clean coal factory? And you're seeing like a field, right? Here's our new clean coal plant. There's nothing there because there's no such thing as clean coal. And I'm so pleased to see somebody is running ads that point that out. But anyhow, the fossil fuel industry, you know, they don't care what happens to the auto industry, frankly, and the workers in the auto industry. long as people continue to drive their cars, even if they're older cars. 27 minutes past you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Back to your radio support group for We the People. Tom Hartman here with you. I guess I'm just a broadcasting junkie. I did Carl's show for 3 hours this morning. I'm doing this show for 3 hours. I'm doing 2 hours on live in Chicago this afternoon. And then tonight at 5 o'clock Pacific time, 8 o'clock Eastern time, I'll be on Keith Olbermann's show. So it's going to be a long day. And then hop on a plane to Michigan, where I'll be doing my show from Grand Rapids on Michigan, on Monday, rather, WTKG. And time now.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starch white shed?
Our bigger piggy alert.
Find the bigger piggies stirring up the dirt.
They always have white shirts.
Always have clean shirts to play.
Yes, indeed. The Federal Reserve, this is from Bloomberg News, refused a request by Bloomberg News. Just out. The Federal Reserve refused a request by Bloomberg News to disclose the recipients of more than $2 trillion of emergency loans from U.S. taxpayers. You thought it was a $700 billion bailout? Well, that's the official bailout. That's what the Treasury Department is bailing out. But the Fed has bailed out $2 trillion. So we're at $2.7 trillion already. Bloomberg filed suit in November under the Freedom of Information Act. The Fed responded on December 8th saying it's allowed to withhold internal memos. Right. Representative Congressman David Scott, a Georgia Democrat, said Americans have been bamboozled. I would say that is putting it charitably. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Anthony in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Yeah, this is Anthony. I work for Chrysler, and today is my last day.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm a proud UAW member, but I think that the UAW should change their system, too, about this seniority, because it's not healthy for the industry. They should get rid of the underperformers and forget about seniority if they want the victory to survive. What's your position about this, Tom?
I think that there's a lot to be said for seniority. The main reason why, and frankly, you see this in any institution, you see this in any business. I mean, very often people with seniority, the ones who work their way up to the top, that seniority is typically equated with experience, with understanding the system, with commitment. This is the reason, frankly, and thanks for the call, Anthony. It's the reason why I like super delegates in the Democratic Party. And I know that there's a lot of progressives who say, what? You know, 20% of the votes of the Democratic Party are decided by people that we didn't elect? Yeah, the Democratic Party is like a club. I mean, it really is. You join the club, you join the Democratic Party, and I think that those people who have really committed their lives to the party, who are elected officials, which is how you get to be a superdelegate, who have put their lives on the line and completely committed their lives to it, should have a reliable say in it. And I want them to, because they provide stability to it. And I think that the seniority system within unions provides some stability to the unions, and that's why I think it's a good idea, frankly. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yes, sir.
Prior to the election, I received mailer after mailer saying that Al Franken wants to take away my right to a secret ballot. And at the time, I didn't know much about the Employee Free Choice Act, but the fact that the mailer was sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce supposed to be supporting labor told me it was obvious propaganda.
Yeah.
My point is that this whole con about the Employee Free Choice Act seems like it should be obvious, but maybe labor hasn't been as effective as the Chamber of Commerce.
They have not been, and they don't have as many dollars, and they don't get picked up by the media. They don't have all these mouthpieces on the media. I mean, you've got a whole bunch of commentators right across the board, you know, from the Joe Scarboroughs of the world to the Lou Dobbses of the world to all, you know, all the people on the radio, but even some of the news, so-called news reporters, echoing this thing about, well, don't you want to have a private vote? Don't you want to have a secret vote? And here's the deal. When I say I want to participate in selecting my government here in Portland, Oregon, in the city at the state level or at the federal level, when I say I want to be a part of the relatively small group in this nation, it's less than a majority of citizens who make the decisions about what's going on, I publicly state that by registering to vote. After I've registered to vote publicly and stated that I'm in favor of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, or I'm an independent, after I've done that publicly and that registration, that voter registration is a public document, then I get to privately vote on the details. And it's the same thing. It's the same thing with the Employee Free Choice Act. You publicly say, yeah, I'd like to be a member of a union in this workplace. Yes, I would like to be a member of a union. And then you have the vote. Okay, who's going to be who are you going to elect as the union president? Are you going to vote for this contract or not? What do you think the wages should be? All of those are private, secret votes. Once the union is in place, all the votes are private and secret votes. So the initial vote is, in my mind, the same thing as voter registration. And I have no problem with it being a public thing. I would publicly state that I think that, you know, we should have continue to have a union at my place of work. This whole thing of, the union bosses are going to strong-arm people. Come on, give me a break.
Well, what people don't understand is the companies are strong-arming people right now because now it's up to the company, whether it's a private or a public vote. So
you betcha. And they're doing it with it's a multi-billion-dollar industry right now of busting unions and coming in and educating, in quotes, workers. John, thanks a lot for the call there from Minneapolis. Richard in Los Angeles. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I did some checking on the screen. It says the average senator and congressman salary is $169,300. Plus, they get over $1 million in compensation for their staff.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to know, and I keep missing when I'm trying to get in to talk to Bernie Sanders, what gives Congress and the Senate the right to vote themselves raises when we are their employers and we never get to say so? Plus, they get virtual salaries even after they're out of office if it's only one term.
Yeah. Well, technically, they can't vote themselves a raise. This was actually an amendment to the Constitution, which says that whenever Congress votes for a raise, that raise doesn't become effective until after the next election. So the people technically are not voting for their own raises. But the fact of the matter is that the funding of government, all appropriations have to begin in the House of Representatives. It's in the Constitution. The only body in government that can say we're going to take taxpayers' dollars and spend them is the House of Representatives. So if the salaries of Congress are going to be changed, they can't be changed by you and me. There's no provision in the Constitution for that. They have to be changed by Congress. And I could build a strong case that members of Congress are underpaid in that you've got people who are sleeping in, you know, three up in apartments. It's some of these members of Congress. I mean, it's downright almost embarrassing, I think, to American democracy, how they have to live in order to have, particularly those who live a long way away from Washington, D.C., in order to have a home in their home district and also have a place on Capitol Hill where it's incredibly expensive to live. On the other hand, I think that the real solution is public financing, because every United States senator wakes up, or on average, the average American U.S. senator wakes up every morning knowing that they've got to raise $20,000 that day, or, you know, they're going to be out of office come the next election, because it has become so expensive to run for the U.S. Senate. And that's why we need public financing, frankly. Michelle in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Oh, good afternoon, Tom. I had two comments. The first is, I live here in Pennsylvania, and in my opinion, I don't think that the state ever recovered from losing the steel industry.
You're right.
It became very dire. And my concern is that if this would happen to Michigan, you know, to the tune of 3 million people, I mean, that's one third of their population. It really never has. My generation has probably never even seen an active steel industry as we knew it. So, this is something that I think we really have to, you know, take into consideration.
Yep, I think.
The second comment
Michelle came and went, but you're absolutely right, Michelle, and it is something that we need to be concerned about. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You and Bernie were talking about electric car.
Yeah.
And the Chevrolet Volt will do the first 40 miles on the lithium-ion charge, and then the hybrid engine kicks in.
Right.
But if you go to Google, do you have a computer in front of you?
I do, but I'm not going to type on it right now while we're talking.
If you go to Google and you put in the word lithium battery mm-hmm. and a couple spaces and the word Korea, K-O-R-E-A, the country Korea,
right.
they've reformulated the battery, and now it's 8 to 9 times as efficient. Mm-hmm. So that's 8 times 40. That's 360 miles on a charge.
Wow.
So I think that this could be the beginning of a whole new electric car business, and I'd like to see our companies follow suit and really help us clean up the air and stop global warming. So that's lithium battery and then the word Korea.
Okay. Thank you, Harvey. Yeah, and to my point, I wasn't saying that the answer to everything is held by Chevron and being kept off the market at this moment. There's been a lot of technology improvement since 1980, but there's also been a lot of time passed since 1980 when we had no electric cars. Danny in Wenatchee, Washington. Hey, Danny, got about a minute here. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I was hoping to talk to Bernie. I would like the government to buy cars from the big three. That's what they need to do is sell them.
That's what they did in Alabama. You know, when they went to Mercedes and they said, we'd like you to move your factory to Alabama, they said, and by the way, we'll buy the first 2,500 cars you make, which is not
exactly
an insignificant amount of money.
Do about $100 million a month, $300 million from each, $100 million from each one of the big three for 24 months. Renew the government fleet, pass the others down to cities and counties that are broke, with the stipulation no layoffs, no plant closures within the United States.
Yeah,
they don't owe us anything. We got a whole new fleet of cars.
There you go. And by the way, we want them to be plug-in electrics or plug-in hybrids. It sounds good to me, Danny. I think you got the plan there. Well done. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. TomHartman.com, our website, AirAmerica.com, our free video stream, 866-303-2270, our phone number.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman program.
Where despair is not an option. Get out there. Get active. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And Andy Barr with the Al Franken campaign. The guy who on Air America used to sit in this day part, although I guess we were competing, actually. Hey, Andy, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
I am just great. I understand that you guys had a victory, might be too strong a word, but a very interesting ruling from the State Elections Commission.
Well, I think it was a victory for all Minnesotans who take pride in our electoral system here. I think what it showed is that here in Minnesota we don't disenfranchise voters. Let me tell you the two things that the canvassing board decided today. They ruled on two matters. One is in this precinct in Minneapolis near the University of Minnesota, the city lost an envelope containing 133 ballots. The Coleman campaign was of the opinion that, well, those 133 people don't get to vote. We pointed out that there's a century's worth of precedent for reverting for that precinct to the election night totals in which those 133 votes were counted. And the state canvassing board, in a unanimous decision today, ruled that in fact, they will accept the election night totals. The second thing has to do with wrongly rejected absentee ballots. And, you know, we've got a video up on YouTube that's got over 37,000 views already.
I saw it.
Talking about seven stories of people who did everything right. They learned about the candidates. They registered. They applied for their ballots. They filled them out correctly. And due to a simple administrative error, they were classified as rejected. The counties have been in the process of sorting out, you know, some ballots were rejected for reasons that aren't even in the list of legal reasons to reject an absentee ballot.
Hmm.
And the state canvassing board today recommended that all counties not only sort those ballots, but open and count the ones that were wrongly rejected. They estimate we could be talking about 1,600 votes that haven't been counted yet.
That's great. And a lot of them in heavily Democratic areas.
Well, you know, and we don't know. These are secret ballots. We don't know what they're going to do, what these voters said. But, you know, our position from the very beginning, Tom, has always been count every legal vote. I think we've said it enough times that people are starting to get sick of hearing it from
us. Yeah, it's what Al Gore was saying in Florida, and it never happened in Florida. And, by the way, let me you haven't said it, so I will. The Al Franken campaign is racking up legal expenses and campaign expenses around this and still needs some help. And people can pitch in. They can toss a few bucks their way, your way, by going to alfranken.com. And I just want to make a pitch for that. I know you're not here to make that pitch, but
and I'm glad you mentioned that, Tom, because the Coleman campaign strategy from the very beginning has been to try to disenfranchise voters. They tried to throw out 32 ballots in Minneapolis by making up a story about how they'd been found in the trunk of somebody's car, which was just totally bogus. I could see them taking additional steps to fight the rulings today that every legal vote should be counted, and we're going to have to fight back. So I'm glad you mentioned that. Indeed, you know, we do have legal bills, and we're keeping the campaign open so that we can defend everyone's right to vote, and the support that we get from listeners to Air America and the Tom Hartman Show is greatly appreciated.
Yeah, the last of the ongoing senatorial campaigns right now, I believe.
I think it's just us and everybody who's already starting in for 2010.
Yep, alfranken.com, the website. Andy, I'm curious, and I realize that you have a bias here, and maybe you don't even want to take a bite at this, but there is a report up at the top of Huffington Post, and it's all over many of the other websites and blogs out there, that Norm Coleman is under FBI investigation, that they're looking at this company that seems to have tried to hand him, or maybe he solicited it. I guess we don't know all the details of it, but they're starting to leak out to hand some six-figure sum of money off to him or his wife. That this is starting to look sort of like a Ted Stevens or Rod Blagojevich kind of situation. Any information on that you want to share with us, or is that something that I should just do myself?
Well, you know, I mean, certainly, and we've said this from the beginning, the sworn allegations that were made in these lawsuits are very serious, but that said, I don't think it would really be proper of me to comment on an ongoing investigation.
I figured, and I think that that's reasonable. Andy, thanks a lot for the update. I appreciate your calling in and sharing it with us.
Hey, thanks, Tom, and thanks to all your listeners for all the great support.
You betcha. And alfranken.com, the website, you can pitch a few bucks Al's way and help out. And spread the word, by the way. Let all your friends know. And if you're not on the mailing list for the campaign, get on their mailing list so you know you can keep up to date on what's going on. Paul in Albany, California. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Well, I actually want to talk about Chrysler's holding company, but can I inject a little humor first?
Sure.
I wonder how much Senator Vitter from Louisiana pays his hookers. Are they on $14 an hour, no benefits?
That's a good one. Or even $24 an hour. I'll bet. Yeah, I'll bet Senator Vitter's prostitutes are making a whole lot more than that, and he's not complaining about that on the floor of the Senate.
He would have been tossed if they had a Republican governor in Louisiana, that he could have been replaced by a Republican.
Yeah.
But the Republicans refused to do anything.
But, you know, after his whole thing of his whole mea culpa, admitting to a federal crime, by the way, or to a state crime, a state felony, patronizing a prostitute, after he did that with his wife, he came to the Senate, and the Republicans in the Senate gave him a standing ovation, this guy who got busted for patronizing a hooker.
What I really want to talk about is, and this is what people don't understand, Chrysler is owned by a holding company called Cerebras.
Right.
And that is actually, in mythology, that's the three-headed dog that stands at the gates of hell.
Right. So I thought it was Cerberus, but in any case, yes.
Well, you know, you're right. Maybe I'm wrong, okay? But this company bought a West Coast chain of really moderate department stores, which is called Mervyn's, which is kind of like Kohl's in other parts of the country or whatever. And then what they did was they sold all the properties and leased the properties back to Mervyn's, and then Mervyn's couldn't afford to pay the rents, and now they just closed down Mervyn's.
Right. This is one of those chop shops. It's like the
right.
it's like what Mitt Romney created with Bain Financial.
Okay. So now when they bought Chrysler, they knew what the conditions were of Chrysler. So why should we even give them a penny? I'm really, and this is Jon Snow, who was allegedly the Secretary of the Treasury.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what he did. But I think that these are the serious issues.
Yeah.
As well as the union issue. But
yeah, there should be, Paul, I am concerned about the loss of good jobs and the loss of union jobs with Chrysler going down. Frankly, it's a very real concern. I think we all should be paying attention to it. On the other hand, you're right. Jon Snow is running the company. He helped run this country into the ground. Yeah, it's a tough one. 58 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270 on our Anything Goes Friday. A lot going on in the world. Susan in Bellevue, Washington, you wanted to disagree with me, so you go to the phone.
Yes, I wanted to disagree with you. First, I want to tell you that I had the opportunity to meet Al Franken last night at a fundraiser here in Seattle. He was he was wonderful.
He's a good guy.
Everybody should give him money to get this thing finished. But I am disagreeing with you about the vote, whether it should be public or private. I don't think it's the analogy that you gave is really fair. I think that it should be secret whether a person gets to vote up or down on a union, because if it's not and they vote for a union and it doesn't make it, then these people are going to be harassed by their managers for having wanted to be in a union, and I think that the up or down vote should be secret.
Here's the problem, Susan. First of all, the Employee Free Choice Act does not do away with the ability of an employer or the employees who want to have a union to hold a secret vote about whether or not to have a union. That's how it is right now.
Yes, that's how it is right now.
And that will continue. So if the employees want to do it in secret, they can say we want to have a secret vote. The problem is somebody has to hold that vote, and that's the employer. It's in the workplace. That vote is held in the workplace. And when the employer gets control of that vote process, they also have control of the ability to indoctrinate the employees, to threaten the employees, to make statements to the employees, to hold meetings with the employees. And it's illegal for people who are organizing to have similar conversations with employees in the workplace. It's against the law. So and people can be fired for it. Or I don't know if it's against the law, but people can legitimately be fired for that. It's not illegal to fire somebody for that.
But it doesn't sound like this legislation is going to change that.
It doesn't change that at all. That can still happen. In other words, people can still have a secret vote. The vote is held in the workplace. It's overseen by the National Labor Relations Board. Or if they choose, they can simply sign a card and say, yes, I want to have a union. And when the union organizers have collected more than 50% of the employees, in other words, if there's 100 people working there, if they can get 51 people to sign a card, then boom, you've got a union. And the employer can't do anything to stop it. They may not even see it coming. They won't be able to say.
Will they get to see those cards and who signed them?
Yes, it's a public document.
Okay. See, that's.
But see, well, now you've got a union. Now you've got a union. Once you've got the union, I've got protection against reprisals by the employer. It's against the law to have reprisal. So, so what if my employer knows that I voted for the union? They've got the union now. They're stuck with it. If the union doesn't have, let's say it's 100 employees again, if they don't get 51 cards, they're not going to turn in 39 cards and say, hey, we got 39 people here who want a union. Why don't you go fire them?
Got it. Okay, that was going to be my answer. Okay, as Rachel would say, you talked me down.
Okay, thank you for calling, Susan.
Okay, bye-bye.
I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. David in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great.
I keep hearing, when you were on the phone with, Bernie, and that there's all these incidents of Texaco, Chevron, other companies, that it's against their business interests for certain technology patents to be available. To be exploited and so on. I'm curious what your thoughts are. To me, it's a national security issue. It's an economic issue. Even though I think we're all a little shy of executive power, what's to stop, say, a President Obama issuing an executive order that says, you know what, this is a national security issue. We're going to take these patents that you're purposely sitting on, and we're going to make sure the people that will use them for the good of the country have access to them. I mean, is that even legal?
You're talking about the Chevron battery patent?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It may be a moot point, as an earlier caller pointed out. That is a 20-year-old technology, and it was a big deal for 15 or 20 years, and it may not be so big a deal anymore. But, yeah, I, I don't know if there's a provision at law. That's a question you'd have, you know, someday maybe we'll have a patent lawyer on, we could ask or something, but, or if there's a, some sort of a version of eminent domain, you know, the ability to override, eminent domain overrides property rights, and a patent is a form of intellectual property protection. So could the Fifth Amendment, you know, taking by the government, the right of the government to take things for public purposes, could that be interpreted with regard to patents? My guess would be that it could be, because property is property. I mean, that's the whole argument that Disney makes and everybody else makes, the pharmaceutical companies with the patents on their drugs, Disney with the trademarks on Mickey Mouse and whatnot. That's the argument that they all make, is that they're protecting a property. Property, you know, and going back to John Locke, you know, life, liberty, and private property, the right of a state. And so it would make sense to me. But I honestly, I don't know, David. It's something that I think probably we ought to look into. David in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Just great.
I want to ask about the predatory lending and credit card loans and all that. Mm-hmm. If they use federal money or the bailout money, whatever you want to call it, to obliterate the debt that people are up to their eyeballs in. I mean, they literally are handcuffed because they have no money for nothing. Of course, it's the people's fault for living the way they do, but nobody, you know, the Wall Street and all that, everybody messed up in one way or another, so nobody really deserves it.
Actually, it wasn't everybody who messed up in one way or another, David. There was a small group of right-wing conservative ideologues, and there's some excellent writing on this recently, who Alan Greenspan at the head of the bunch, by the way, who believed the Reagan mantra and believed the Ayn Rand mantra and believed the libertarian mantra that if government totally gets out of the way, that so-called free markets will self-regulate. And Phil Gramm in 1999, doing it with Glass-Steagall and other deregulations, set the stage for a small handful of very smart and very greedy people to throw out into the world hundreds of trillions of dollars of bets and merging. You know, it used to be that investment banks and commercial banks were very different things. Investment banks were banks that handled 99.99% of their business was handling rich people's money. And so they could afford to invest in high risk investments, things where there was a high risk of losing everything because it was wealthy people who could afford to lose at least the money that they were handing over to the bank for investment. On the other hand, commercial banks had to be very, very conservative because they were handling the money of businesses. They were handling the money of corporations. They were handling the money of the average people. And so commercial banks were not allowed to engage in risky investments. They were not allowed to, for example, participate in creating new stock offerings and bringing new companies to the market. And what Phil Gramm did in 99 was he broke the barrier between the two, which had been put in place in 1936 or 37 by the Glass-Steagall Act. He broke that. And so we saw a repeat of what happened in the late 1920s that led directly to the first Republican Great Depression. And this being we're on the leading edge, in my opinion, of the second Republican Great Depression as a consequence of banks getting into the gambling business.
Well, my thought was, what would happen if they just obliterated all that bad credit debt and then just didn't issue any more cards? That would free up so much finances for so many people. Because right now, I think
it's not credit cards, David. It's these bets. What happened is you can under the rules as they were, or the non-rules as they were allowed by the Securities and Exchange Commission had a hand in this, and the Fed had a hand in this. Alan Greenspan. Under these non-rules, a bank could create out of nothing. And a betting instrument. In other words, they could say, you want to bet that the U.S. dollar is going to go up or down? And, you know, these credit default swaps, these became a new kind of derivative. You want to bet that the dollar is going to go down? We'll sell bets on that. And, you know, for $1,000, you can buy a bet. And if you win, you make $10,000. And if you lose your $1,000 or whatever. And so these derivatives got sold that were bets. And there were bets on the weather. There were bets on crop failures. There were bets on the prices of every commodity out there. They were in the first iteration, they were sold as credit default swaps. In other words, they were first sold as betting on whether or not people would default on credit instruments, principally mortgages. But then people started selling bets on whether people would lose or win on the credit default swap itself. So in other words, I have a mortgage on my home. Somebody writes a bet on whether or not I'm going to default. And then somebody else writes a bet on whether or not that second person, they're going to win or lose their bet on whether or not my home is going to default. And then somebody else writes a bet on whether the third party's bet is going to pay off about the second party's bet about whether or not I'm going to pay off my mortgage. That's how it happened. They were literally creating betting instruments out of nothing. And what happened was that these investment banks, which used to be able to do high-risk stuff, and, you know, okay, they can do high-risk stuff. They're only handling rich people's money. They merged with commercial banks after 1999 as a result of this Republican push through Congress and Bill Clinton's signature, by the way. They merged, and everybody got caught up in this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The liberal shadow knows.
Yes, he does. He does, and he has the information. Here is about the evil that lurks in the hearts of men. The White House has turned down a request from the family of President-elect Barack Obama to move into Blair House. Now, Blair House is the official guest house for the President of the United States. The White House comes with its own official guest house. It's located at 1651 Pennsylvania Avenue, opposite the old executive office building. It's, you know, right around the corner from the White House. And literally, it is the guest house for the White House. When you become president, you have the White House, and you have guest rooms in the White House where you can put people, and you also have a guest house. And typically, the outgoing president makes Blair House available to the incoming president before the inauguration. And to hear this story from the New York Times by Helene Cooper. The Obamas were told the Blair House, where incoming presidents usually stay in the 5 days before Inauguration Day, is booked in early January, a spokesperson to the Obama transition said. And we explored the idea so the girls could start school on schedule. They're talking about Malia and Sasha. The Obamas wanted to move to Washington, D.C. a couple of weeks before the inauguration so that their daughters could start school on time. And the White House says no. It remained unclear, writes Helene Cooper in today's New York Times, it remained unclear who on the Bush's guest list outranks the incoming president. It's not a public schedule, said Sally McDonough, spokeswoman for First Lady Laura Bush, in refusing to disclose who is staying at Blair House. It's not a question about ranking the Obamas. Blair House will be available to them on January 15th. Ms. McDonough said, there's nothing more to say other than that it's not available and won't be available until January 15th. You're trying to make a story out of something that's not a story. Right. We'll just leave it at that. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Rick in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Rick, what's on your mind?
Hey, this whole bailout situation, what is happening today is we've been through 30 years of basically Reaganomics, deregulation, the trickle-down theory, and it doesn't work.
No, it's destroyed our country, just like it did in the 1920s when they tried it.
It did, but what has to happen is it has to play its course. And you mentioned the 1920s. Post-World War II, the Greatest Generation basically used the labor unions to control the corrupt politicians and corporations, and they basically created the greatest economic system in the history of mankind. If you look at the Industrial Revolution, you got 30 or 40 years up until 1929, and the system collapses. At that time, you were able to exploit the immigrants coming into the country. So you can make a correlation between what went on back then and what is going on today. So we can't look at the numbers. The numbers are just ridiculous. What you have to look at today is, are we going to change policy? Are we going to change the philosophy and the ideology? Get back to circulating wealth through the middle rather than through the top. But saying that, people think that you vote in somebody and then they're going to, then things are going to change. The change comes from society.
Yeah.
And like I say, that the change that I'm 50 years old, you know, when I grew up in Detroit, there was an ideology in place. Well, today that's no longer there. So
yeah.
Here we are at a crossroads.
Yep, I agree, Rick, and that's well said. This is what's being rolled back.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And this was what the guy who called Bernie and started saying, all you guys should resign, was expressing. The idea that government is inherently evil and corrupt. It's the storyline that the Blagojevich story plays into, which is one of the reasons that conservative media is all over it, not to ignore the fact that the guy's a Democrat. And it's their narrative. It's that government is wrong and bad and evil, and corporations and rule by a wealthy elite is good and noble and how things should be run. I mean, that's the bottom line. They never tell you the second half of the equation, but you can't have the first half without the second half, because somebody's got to be in charge. And if it's not we the people through a democratically elected government, then it's going to be the corporations and the very, very wealthy few. And that was the case in the United States during the robber baron era from the 1870s until 1901. It was true in the United States from 1920 until 1932, that you had the government being run basically out of the offices of a handful of very, very wealthy, in many cases bankers, but also railroad barons, manufacturers, oil guys, you know, John D. Rockefeller and company. I mean, basically it was the rule by the wealthy elite. And from the Republican point of view, that's the healthier way to run a country. Because they really and truly believe that the fundamental nature of people is to be evil. And so a values-neutral institution like a corporation will always be superior to democracy, where all of the evil people get to vote. Whereas liberals historically have said, going all the way back to Jefferson and Franklin and Madison and George Washington, that no, the people are good. The people can make decisions for themselves. And we need to have as much small-d democracy as possible, which, by the way, includes democracy in the workplace, which is called a union, which the Republicans are now trying to destroy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Back 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to teamster.org for more information. And just a personal plug here, if you're looking for a charity for the holidays, back in 1978, Louise and I started a community for abused kids in New Hampshire. It's still there. It's a great charity. It's a great program. 100% of all the money you give actually goes to support the program itself. Their website is SalemChildrensVillage.org. So just couldn't, you know, it's the holiday season. I gotta let you know about it. And what not to do.
Better take off your coat.
Our full Monty alert for the day.
David, take off your shoes. I'll take your shoes.
Yeah, this happened in Detroit, actually.
Baby, take off your dress. Yes, yes, yes. You can't leave your hat on.
Yeah, you can leave your hat on, and in this case, she left her handcuff on. Detroit Free Press. Can you imagine this poor guy getting his name in the paper? Detroit Free Press is reporting about a suburban Detroit couple, the man who called the police and said, please come unhandcuff my wife from the bed. The police, Dearborn Police, used a universal key to free the woman. Sergeant Ray Patrick calls the situation more of an intimate relationship than an unlawful imprisonment. Hey, Louise, there's an idea. Louise? Where'd she go? 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Richard in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to talk about the Fifth Estate. I keep reading about online, I keep reading in the news that the newspapers around the country are also going bankrupt, and I wonder if maybe we shouldn't start rescuing them. And I wanted to bring up a quote from Jefferson where he says, whenever the people are well-informed, they can be trusted with their own government. That whenever things get so far wrong as to attract their notice, they may be relied upon to set things right.
Yes.
And unless we have that Fifth Estate, the informed local press, you know, we can't really trust the national media like Fox. Maybe we need to start propping up the local newspapers, helping them transition into the 21st century electronic media.
I think what we need to do is encourage local newspapers to go back to being local newspapers. And that has to do with enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and those rules. But your point is well taken, Richard, and thanks for calling and making it. Jason in Seattle, you have information on patents and national security?
Yeah, there is a provision in patent law that allows the government to, at the review process, they can take any patent or prevent it from going into industry that they deem in the interest of national security. So there is a provision for that.
So I was, but, my guess was right. That's good to know. Thank you, Jason. I appreciate the call. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, Mark in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom, thank you for all you do. I just wanted to point out a simple fact that, you know, while we're talking about the effects on blue collars with the breaking the unions, this is also going to affect white-collar workers whose salaries have always been based a little above the union scale. So this is going to affect all Americans, and Americans need to be thinking about the fact that white-collar workers need to pull their heads out of the sand and realize that they are also going to be affected by the breaking of unions. And in the spirit of the holiday season, to remind folks that Bob Cratchit was a white-collar worker.
Yeah, he was, actually, wasn't he? He was a bookkeeper or some variation thereof. Excellent. Mark, thank you very much. That's great. Derek in Thousand Oaks, California. Hey, Derek, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, thanks for taking my call. I love your show so much. You know, I agree completely with your position that basically money and worldwide corporations, when left to their own devices, really don't care about people at all.
By and large,
And my big question, though, when you just mentioned Sherman Antitrust, and that brings up a big question for me, and that is that definitely that has to be reinforced and the large media broken up, because the problem that I see is that, like, for instance, with 9/11 Truth and with issues, you there?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, sorry about that. With 9/11 Truth and issues like depleted uranium, which is a huge pollutant issue that is really not spoken about at all in the media, I mean, how do those things get heard?
Depleted uranium is our Agent Orange. It's this generation's Agent Orange and will be, mark my words, 10, 15 years from now, maybe less, we will be hearing the same kind of stories about depleted uranium and the vets coming back from Iraq that we're hearing right now about Agent Orange in the Vietnam era. And not to mention the millions of Vietnamese that Agent Orange was poured on and the millions of Iraqis that depleted uranium was poured on. Yeah, absolutely. No, we need a free press. We need a diversified media. Over 90% of everything that Americans see, hear, and read is filtered through the hands of fewer than a dozen corporations. Depends on how you do the math and whose numbers you're using, but typically most people agree with Ben Bogdanovich, I think is his name, who wrote The Media Monopoly, that it's six or seven corporations at this point. And it's not right. And frankly, I think the bigger is better theory is one of the problems that Detroit has right now. You know, they've got all these different brands, and frankly, you know, Buick should be making Buick, and Oldsmobile should be making Oldsmobile, and Chevrolet should be making Chevrolet. But they all merged under General Motors, and, you know, here we are. So I would even apply the Sherman Act to the auto manufacturers, but let them keep their unions. That's got nothing to do with the issue that's going on right now, because the real issue that's going on right now is busting unions. That's what this is all about. Larry in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Larry.
Yes, Tom, I have a different viewpoint here. You know, I love you and Bernie, and I love all the stuff you're talking about, but you're talking about things at a high level, and the Republicans in the Senate have been able to do what they want to do. I mean, I'm against the filibuster. I hope we can gut the filibuster. Right. Last night is a good example of what the filibuster can do. 52 votes were there. People in foreign countries are going to be looking at us and saying, 52 votes? That's a majority. Why? I thought this was a democracy. Why can't you get a vote, you know, a vote done with 52 votes?
Yeah.
And, you know, basically the filibuster has been used mainly by the Republicans. The Democrats tried to use it here, and we ended up with Alito and Roberts.
Right. They threatened the nuclear option. They threatened to blow up the filibuster. And this is the point, Larry, and this is where those of us who are cleaved in some way, in various ways, to the Democratic Party need to acknowledge the problem or part of the problem here. When the filibuster rule was put into place back in the day, it was put into place so that in extraordinary circumstances, a minority of senators could shut down business in the Senate. But they had to pay an extraordinary price in order to do that. They had to stand and talk for days in order to shut down the Senate.
Right. Yeah.
And they used to do that. I remember Strom Thurmond filibustering against civil rights legislation in 1966 and 67. Literally, I mean, they brought in cots for him to sleep on. They brought in a bucket for him to pee in. And they brought in his food. And that's how it worked.
And I think he read from the Bible.
Yeah, actually, for hours.
Right.
And there have been filibusters where they read from the dictionary as well. And if a senator wants to filibuster and really pay the price of a filibuster, then I say, let's keep the filibuster rule in place. The problem is that the Senate Majority Leader is the one who decides whether or not, or actually, the, you know, the, arguably the opposite party, the leader of the opposite party, decides whether or not that they're going to be forced to do a filibuster. Nearly 70 times in the last legislative session, the Republicans shot down Democratic legislation when there were more than 50 votes out of 100. There was a majority of votes for that legislation. They shot it down, not by filibustering, but by threatening to filibuster. The problem is not the filibuster. The problem is Harry Reid. The problem is a Senate majority leader who, when the Republicans say, hey, we're gonna filibuster, we're thinking about filibustering, he goes, oh, okay, I'll take it off the agenda. Don't worry. Nothing going on here. And he says to everybody else, you know, don't look behind that curtain. We've got business to do here in the Senate. And as Bernie Sanders has pointed out on the show a number of times, you know, the thing to do if the Republicans say, you know, we're going to filibuster this, is to say, fine, bring in the cots, get yourself a plastic hose, and, you know, we'll even cater the food. We'll bring the pizza in, but get ready because we're going to call an all-night session, and you're going to be here for a day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, however long you want to shut down the Senate to destroy unions in the United States. We'll let you do it. We'll let you make a spectacle. We'll let you make your point, but when you finally get exhausted, we're going to have our damn vote. And you know, ultimately, those filibusters back in the civil rights era, finally they broke down. You know, the pressure finally got to the senators, and we got the legislation. And frankly, I think these would too. So the problem isn't the 60-vote rule, the filibuster rule. That I think is a reasonable thing to have in there for those times when there's a little bit of hysteria, like, ah, gee, let's get the Patriot Act. See, that's something that should have been filibustered. Or let's rush off to war with Iraq. That's something that should have been filibustered. There are times when the majority gets a little too hysterical and a little too, whatever the word is, you know, a little too quick to act, a little too hair trigger. And the minority needs to be able to restrain them. But 70 times a year? Nah.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks so much to Louise Hartman, to my producer Sean Taylor, to Stephanie Whiteman, Shelley Osterberger, Marcus Hillman, and Michael McDonald at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. That's what makes it happen. And thanks to Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, for providing us with great news on an ongoing basis. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
I am thankful for you.
Thank you. I'm thankful for you, too.
Thank you. So what's going on in the world?
Well, obviously, we've got the whole auto bailout thing, which I'm sure you've heard about ad nauseam.
Yes, and have talked about ad nauseam, but it's, you know, I'm assuming that there are no new developments.
No, and probably won't be today. We know that the White House, in an about turn this morning, has indicated that the money could come from the TARP program, and that's the big story. The more interesting story to me, I think, is Senator Patrick Leahy, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, coming under pressure from Republicans to slow down the hearings for the confirmation of Eric Holder as Attorney General.
Right, and Leahy coming out and saying that it's Karl Rove behind this. I'm of the opinion, and to tell me if I'm a conspiracy nut or not, that they're concerned that Eric Holder will start criminal prosecutions against Karl Rove for anything from Don Siegelman to the other many corrupt things that he was involved with, Republicans violating what do you call it when a court bans people from activity, restraining order that's been against them since the 1980s for voter caging, for example. You know, when we had testimony before Congress that Rove's number one right-hand man, Tim what's-his-name, was in charge of caging operations out of the White House.
Right.
And there's just no shortage of crimes. And Holder has in the past, I believe, said that he is not averse to the idea of holding this administration responsible for things.
Well, they've got to be extremely concerned. And of all the appointments that Barack Obama has made, this is the only one that they can hold up.
Yeah.
This is the only one that there's any taint to.
Right. And they're going to be looking for a Mukasey kind of guy, somebody who's a get-along, go-along, you know, everything's fine, don't worry, somebody that is Republican-friendly in the attorney general spot. And they're going to threaten to filibuster, and probably Harry Reid, if he's true to form, will roll over and say, okay, you know, no problem, tragically.
And that's not what Leahy is indicating he's going to do. Now, I don't know how long they can drag this thing out. If they can drag this out into the new Congress, then presumably the makeup of the committee will shift, and there will be more Democrats on the committee.
Right, right. And actually, will there be?
And more Democrats in the Congress.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be more Democrats in the Congress, but I thought the committees, they always tried to have equal amounts, and then the chairperson was the person who flipped the vote one way or the other.
That's right. You're right. You're right. Okay. They do. They do. Yeah. That's right. They do keep the numbers equal. So it'll be interesting to see which way this pans out. I think that Leahy's going to stick to his guns on this.
Yeah, well, good on him for doing that. And Pat Leahy, by the way, I've met Pat Leahy, and he was my senator for, you know, nearly 10 years that we lived in Vermont. And this guy is no shrinking violet. He's a take names and kick. He's the guy. He's one who could replace Harry Reid, frankly. He was a former federal prosecutor. And Pat Leahy really knows how to get things done.
He gives the impression of being meek and mild. But when you actually listen to what he says, he's not at all.
Oh, he's a very correct and proper guy. I mean, he has the demeanor of somebody who's, you know, like your grandfather, you know, just the friendly grandfather. But you, if you're a lawbreaker, he will throw your ass in jail. I mean,
he's fierce. You're right. He could definitely replace Harry Reid.
Excuse me, your butt in jail.
Yes, exactly. Well, you can follow David Vitter. You could say that.
Okay.
He set the standard.
I guess
so.
I know, but I have standards for my show. So, anyhow, what else is going on in the world?
Well, of course, we've got the report that came out from the Senate Armed Services Committee that you've probably also been talking about, this bipartisan report with not one single dissent. And I think it's important that we bear that in mind, because quite often when we hear about reports that come out from committees, what really happened is that the majority on the committee puts out a report and the minority all grind their teeth and moan about it.
Or issue a minority opinion.
Exactly, or issue a minority opinion. This is not the case. This was put out by Senators Carl Levin and John McCain, a nearly two-year investigation saying that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and other top Bush administration officials were directly responsible for abuse of detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, and other prisons. Now, they didn't look into prisons off-site, the black prisons off in countries unknown. We don't know about that yet.
Yeah, or in Egypt. Apparently, we have a number of them. That will be an even more horrific story, I guarantee you. So now in the first draft of this, I saw a headline or a story that suggested that they actually named George Bush as well as Rumsfeld in this.
I've not been able to find that.
Yeah.
Okay. I've not been able to find that. The Washington Post doesn't say that. I've not seen that in the New York Times. So I've not been able to see that anywhere, and I just read a Newsweek story about it, and it wasn't in there either. So I think if they had nailed George Bush specifically as saying, this is cool, let's do it, they would have said that.
Is there any – now that a bipartisan Senate committee has said that at the very least the former Secretary of Defense is responsible – administration officials are responsible for – harming the reputation of America, encouraging recruiting among the enemy, as it were, and providing poor intelligence. As I recall, those were the three main points. Am I correct in my recollection?
That's correct.
Now that they have said that, do you think that there's any possibility that Rumsfeld is going to be held accountable for this beyond this?
I think there's almost no possibility whatsoever.
That's a tragedy. Victoria, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, and you too. And thanks for the great news reports. On Monday, evangelist Lou Engel, the founder of The Call, is going to tell us all about gay marriage. Okay, we'll see. And Kerry Lucas is going to be out here to talk with me about green jobs. Do they discriminate against women? What? And, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. It all starts with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.